harder than I would like to admit to really let God love me the way he wants to. I'm recovering from spiritual and emotional abuse and addiction to food and work, and been a hyper control freak. Still struggle with that some. Had issues with pornography, with alcohol, with depression. All seen, I'm not sure, is it Febreze, I think, where they use the term nose blind? Is that, have I got that right? Kid lives in a room, you know, full of dirty clothes and who knows what else in the corners and under the bed, and lives there long enough and he doesn't smell it anymore, just smells normal to him. His mom comes in and, oh, do you realize where you're living? He's just nose blind to it. He's so used to a certain level of stinkage in the room that it just smells normal to him. I'm going somewhere with this. So this has nothing to do with nose blind. Just stick that on the shelf and think about that, nose blind. I get so used to the stink, it doesn't stink anymore. So last weekend, we like a green patch. Everybody knows what a salad patch, green patch, you know, kale, turnip greens. Don't know. It's
a garden where you grow lettuce.
No, it's not lettuce. It's kale and turnip greens, mustard greens. Yeah, you cook them, and it's a southern thing, kind of. But anyway, we always like a green patch, a salad patch in our garden, and our crowder peas, purple hull peas, black-eyed peas, you know, not green peas, but field peas, was taking up the spot we needed. So they weren't quite finished with producing what they were going to do, and I thought, well, I'll just pull all the plants, and then I'll sit down in the shade tree, and I'll pull all the pods off, and we'll deal with them. So when we got in the house, I'm like, green beans. These don't have any peas in them. And I said, well, let's just break them up, and we'll try to cook them like green beans and just see, you know, because they're tender and they're not chucky or stringy. So I thought, well, we'll just eat them like green beans. Because every now and then when she cooks crowder peas, she'll put a few little broken up green, you know, and it tastes okay. And, yeah, you're already kind of getting the picture. So we did a whole pot of just the green ones, and she seasoned them much like you would green beans, and they looked a lot like green beans. And so I forget what else we had with the meal, but, you know, we served our plate up with, you know, potatoes and this and that, some sort of meat, and then here's the green peas, beans, whatever. Put a big old plop of that on there, and you take your first bite. And what's weird is it doesn't taste bad. It didn't taste bad, but it didn't taste anything like green beans. And it's like, okay, do I like this? Do I not like this? Do I want to eat any more? I'm not sure. Well, we got to the end of the meal, and she was cleaning up, and she said, so should we keep these or should we throw them out? I said, let's just throw them out. So we fed the coons and the possums out in the edge of the woods. But I got to thinking, what if you grew up in a culture? What if you grew up in a culture that intentionally, all the time, every summer, picked their crowder peas when they were immature, before they put peas in? They're real tender and real succulent, and it didn't have a bad taste. It was just different. And you grew up with that. From day one, that's all you had. When you saw a pile of green bean-looking things on your plate, you grew up knowing what they were going to taste like, you know? And so when you would take a big forkful of that, it would not be, but it didn't taste bad. It just was not what I expected, you know? I expected green beans. And you go to this same culture, and you put down a plate of what we would call green beans, you know? Get a spoonful of that and put it out there and let them eat that. And they would be like, it doesn't taste bad, but let's put them out in the woods. You know, it's not, I don't think we, isn't it weird that you get used to things, so used to things, that you either go nose blind to them or this doesn't taste like green beans. So, and I keep saying it didn't taste bad. It didn't taste bad. It's just like, no, I don't want them to look like green beans but not taste like green beans. I want them to taste like green beans. So the lesson this week on codependency is, for lack of a better term, cultural, theologically, or socioeconomically, or politically, or etiquettely, is that a word even? That we get so used to thinking of things a certain way that it becomes our normal, and we just thoughtlessly think that way, and we become very codependent on that, in that we feel no freedom, and a lot of times no inclination to try to feel any other way, or try anything new, or think in a new way at all. So we're codependent with our culture. Would you like to try this thought? Oh, no, I couldn't, because I'm a Democrat, or because I'm a Republican. Would you like to explore this idea? Oh, no, I couldn't, because I'm a Methodist, or I'm a Baptist, or I'm a Catholic, or whatever. Would you like to go visit these people over here? Oh, no, my family of origin would be so displeased if I went over there with those people. And so we're held hostage by this cultural codependency that the group we belong to, the tribe we belong to, whether we know it or not, dictates the way we think. And most of us would say, oh, no, it doesn't. Okay, so last week, I'm going to offend some people, but I don't really mean to. Last week when I closed the lesson, I said three things that described a bad leader. Three things. If you were a Republican here last week, my guess would be he's talking about Hillary or Obama. That's who he's talking about. If you're a Democrat, you were probably thinking he's talking about Trump. Your thinking is controlled by your culture, by your tribe. Your tribe makes you assume things. Guess what? I wasn't talking about either one. But our minds go there. Our minds make these assumptions because of the tribe we belong to, and so we're not free to think outside of that box. Pretty much, and I know it's my sister's story because she grew up in the same, not even born yet, I don't think, but it was a long time before my mother ever got a wedding ring because the church we went to didn't believe in any kind of jewelry whatsoever. This is a big word, you'll love this. They called it superfluous adornment. That's what they called it. No earrings, no necklaces, no bracelets, nothing like that. No makeup, zero makeup. I remember us going to the dime store one time, and my older sister, our oldest sister was with us, and she wanted to buy some of that make-believe play lipstick. Just little kids, you know, a little bitty tube, costs a nickel or less. Mama, can I have that? She said, oh no. We don't do that. That's wrong. We don't. But, and she named the other preacher in town. She said, but his daughter, who was her classmate, she wears makeup all the time. And Mom was like, yeah, but they're not quite as good as we are. She made it be known. You know, they're spiritually kind of inferior to us. She didn't use those words, but she let it be known in a kind of a condescending way. When I became a pastor in the church we came from, I had guys in my church, men in my church, who wanted to join, and I was going to take them in as a pastor. Found out I couldn't because they were a Mason. There's rules on the books. You can't belong to our church if you're a Mason. Also had people who went to my church who smoked. Guess what? You can't join if you use tobacco in any way. You can't grow it. You can't sell it at Minute Mart. You can't partake of it in any way. You can't join our church if you sell beer or manufacture alcohol or consume alcohol in any way. I thought, what about NyQuil? I guess that doesn't count. Anyway, so I grew up in this strict, strict right-wing evangelical church. We always voted one way. We always said we believed one way. And we called our beliefs our doctrinal distinctives. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we weren't allowed to roller skate because it was too much like dancing. And to dance meant you wanted to have sex with your dance partner. That's what we were taught. So you couldn't even roller skate. So we were brought up in this, and you couldn't play with the playing card. You could play with rook cards, but you couldn't play with playing cards because somehow the face cards had some kind of demonic. Okay. Yeah. Well, see, I got a different explanation. So they changed. The authorities changed. So anyway, I became a pastor in this denomination, and I started meeting people that, of course, didn't grow up in our home, And I started having discussions, and I realized some of these people are really good, good people. And I thought, something is wrong when I can't, they want to join my church that I pastor, and I can't take them in. And I would ask my authorities, what's the deal here? Oh, no, it's in the discipline, blah, blah, blah. And I would say, yeah, but over here we've got a pastor who's about 300 pounds overweight. We don't have an issue with that? No, it doesn't disobey any of these rules here, you know. We've got people over here who, pastors' homes, which I know they're neglecting and or abusing their children. Yeah, that's not good, but yeah, we're not going to disqualify them. So that we were very picky in what rules we wrote and enforced. And that's the only life I knew. That is the only life I knew. And I got in the ministry, and over the years, I stayed, for a while, I stayed in lockstep with it pretty much. I remember when I started to think, this just isn't, no, I can't go with this. My denomination tells me that Jesus hates gays and lesbians. No, that can't be right. So I had friends who were gay and lesbian. I thought, I'm not supposed to love them. I'm not supposed to, they're my friends, you know? And I didn't understand that. I rode horses a lot in Tennessee. And I rode horses with people who made moonshine, literally. People who made, they legally make it, Short Mountain Distillery. But back then it was illegal. People who made meth, people who dealt in drugs, people who did all kind of crazy stuff. And I rode horses with them every week. And that's part of the reason I got kicked out of my last church. We don't like you hanging out with these people. And so the longer I went, the more I thought, I just can't embrace what my culture, what my tribe tells me I'm supposed to embrace. My heart just isn't there. I can't do that anymore. And so ultimately, we got kicked out. And we moved here to Bowling Green and found, you know that part of the story. We found Celebrate Recovery and got involved and then eventually was asked to lead, and then it became Pathway, so you know that part of the story. But over time, some of the key people in my recovery, I've had several lesbians who played huge parts in my recovery in the name of Jesus and loved Jesus as much as I did. And I thought, I can't keep embracing the old tribal. I can't do that anymore. So that was a big thing. I interacted with a lot of people with a different mindset politically than I'd grown up with. And I thought, I can't think the old political thoughts I used to think anymore. I just can't go there. And so the last, since 05, well, it started happening before that, but 05 is when we moved to Bowling Green, and 05 is when we got involved in Celebrate Recovery. Since then, my life has been a huge paradigm shift. And a lot of it is, not all of it, but a lot of it is that I linked up with Wayne Hunter. And he was asking the same questions as me, and because he came out of the same denomination, the same conference and everything, and was pretty much kind of kicked out himself. So we had similar stories. But we write instead, And so we kind of gave each other permission to ask questions and to explore and to grow, you know, and to dig deeper. And so there's several things I'd like to leave us with tonight. But one thing I would really like to encourage us to do is to find a soulmate, find a heart, a heart kin, I like to call it, who is as curious as you are. You don't need some kind of radical rebel who says, you know, let's destroy the world. It's probably not somebody you want to partner with. But find somebody who's curious and somebody who's open and say, can we explore this together? Because it's kind of checks and balances. You kind of keep each other in check. And when you discover new stuff, you don't say, I discovered it. You say, we discovered it, which is really cool. Takes the ego out of it. There's no ego involved. So that's one thing, is just the idea of having a partner. Well, let me say this. So If you're here tonight, you may be saying, well, I know this applies to everybody else here, but it doesn't apply to me because I'm completely open-minded. I'm completely free-thinking. There's no way that my tribe has any control over me, you know. Dear Jesus. The residue is so thick. The claws our culture gets in it are so deep and so insidious that it, for any of us to say we're completely free from cultural restraint or cultural codependency is kind of foolhardy. The best thing to do is just swallow hard and say, yeah, I'm more tribal than I'd like to admit. But here's some thoughts. These are just thoughts. I'm not telling anybody what to do. It's just thoughts to throw out there. But one thing that you can, this especially applies to any other kind of tribe that is possessive and says you have to stay in lockstep with us. I've always told people who are really sucked into radical religious organizations, and I say it sounds a lot like a cult. Oh, no, we're not a cult. We're not a cult. And what I, can I say where y'all went to church? Is it okay? Okay. Like where we came from was full of Church of Christ people. I mean, it was the Church of Christ was the denomination everywhere. And I would, if I got close enough to some of them talking, I would say, you know, your church is kind of like a cult. Oh, no. We are, a cult is like they tell you everything you're supposed to think, everything you're supposed to do. You have no freedom to be yourself. And if you don't do it their way, you go to hell. That's a cult. Yeah. There you go. There you go. Yeah. So if you like in that kind of setting, what I always, and these people from Woodbury, Tennessee, Canyon County, where we came from, who went to the Church of Christ, if they got open and honest enough with me, I'd say, you know, you really know that the Church of Christ is basically a cult. Oh, no, it's not. I would say, okay, then try to leave it. That's the test with a cult. If you don't think your church is a cult, just try to leave. See what happens when you try to leave. If you think your tribe is not a cult or your political persuasion is not a cult or whatever it is, try to leave. Just try to leave and see what happens. See what the backlash is from your tribe. That tells you a lot right there. Just some thoughts. All right, here's another thought. If any of this tonight is at least mildly intriguing to you, you're just like, well, it's not me, but I'll think about it some. Because none of us want to admit we're culturally codependent. I mean, who would be culturally codependent? Yeah, I see that. Is there another? There you go. Here's something to try. Strike up a conversation with somebody who has a diametrically opposed point of view than you. And you know they have an absolutely different point of view. If you're a right-wing Republican, find the most rabid, radical left-wing Democrat. Sit down for 2 hours of coffee and determine that you're not going to try to make a Republican out of them. Just determine you're going to talk to them about it. If you're a left-wing Democrat, sit down with a right-wing Republican and say, I just want to talk. I'm not going to try to convince you I'm right and you're wrong. I just want to talk. And you think, I would never do that. And what's driving that? Could we possibly be culturally codependent? Because, no, I'm not going to talk to them. Wow, us and them. Not going to talk to them. Well, yeah, I'll talk to them and convince them to become what I am, but I'm not going to talk to them and find out their story and where they came from and just leave it at that. I'm not going to do that. There are lots of, they say never talk about religion or politics, right? That's what they say. Why is that? Because politics and religion are so cultish. They're so tribal. They're so, if I'm going to vote this way, then that means I'm convinced I'm right, which means if you don't vote my way, then I'm convinced you're wrong. See how, what's built in? Oh, and look, I have other ones just like me. See? And I think there's more of us than them because we won the election, whichever way it goes. So we're more right than you are. And so in our culture, this has gotten worse and worse and worse till we've got long life friends that can't go out for coffee anymore because it's us than them. It's this tribalism. And if there's anything that we learn in Pathway is that the value of human relationships is to hear each other's stories, not to try to convince or fix or correct, but just hear each other's stories. Who are you? Where did you come from? Tell me how you feel about this. Tell me, you know, and just hear each other's stories in a simple, simple way without feeling like we have to correct or fix the other person. Here's the last thing I want to say tonight. The further I get into recovery, and I'm 05 to 19, what is that, 14 years, right? Yeah, 14 years in recovery. This started about 6-7 years ago. No, it started longer than that, but it's grown and grown and grown. I am deeply, deeply convinced that we cannot be truly healthy and whole in our relationships with our people and with ourselves and with our God until we are no longer culturally codependent. I think that nobody ever talks about this. Nobody ever brings this subject up of dare we think different from our tribe? Dare we be free thinkers? Because how can I relate to somebody who I really want to love if they're one of those? In my mind, they're still one of those people. How can I be truly free and generous? I really love you, but I wish you weren't a Baptist, or I wish you weren't a this or that, you know. I really love you, but I wish you weren't a Democrat, or I wish you weren't a Republican, or I wish you weren't wealthy, or I wish you weren't poor, you know. And you think it doesn't make a difference, but really get honest, y'all. Really get honest. Culturally codependent. We let it make a difference because we're culturally codependent. I remember, now that I've forgiven my father, now that I've forgiven my father, I'm starting to see so many of the good things about him. He was a good, good man. He was a clumsy father. At least to a son, some to the daughters, but mostly to the son. Clumsy father, but he was a good, good man. And I watched Dad entertain college and seminary presidents, PhDs, world-renowned missionaries, I mean, that were known the world over, all kinds of highfalutin church leaders. I saw him entertain them at the dinner table and talk to them. And I also saw him. There was a guy, I don't know if you remember Eggs Wilhoit. There was a guy in Wilmore who was basically a garbage man, and he also had a lot of chickens, and so he gathered the eggs, and he would sell the eggs, and so we called him Eggs. He was George Wilhoit, so his name was George Eggs Wilhoit. Kind of a Wilmore joke on him is he was going down the main street of Wilmore one time, which was a gentle grade, and he'd always drove this nasty old beat-up pickup truck. And his arms were so long, when he hung them out the window, his hands nearly drug the ground. He was just this big old tall guy. But he was driving down Lexington Avenue, and he looked over in the back tire of his truck, just came rolling right by him. And he's just like, oh, that shouldn't be. He pulled over and got some help and got the tire put back on. But he knew my dad. And one time he found some old firewood, so loaded it. Before my dad got home from work, and Mom was like, what do we do about this? What do we do? So Dad comes home, and George Eggs said, I had to sell this firewood, and I knew if I unloaded it, you would buy it. And Dad said, yeah. And he bought it, gave him a good price for it, and he treated him with every bit of the respect he would treat a college president or whatever. So this is deep-seated in me, but I missed it for a long time. I missed it for a long, long time. And I also missed the fact that my father, our father, went cross-grain to our tribe several times. I mean cross-grain. Stood his ground and said, I know this is what the tribe tells me I'm supposed to believe, but I don't believe that. I remember one time, he always voted one way. I'm not going to say which way. He always voted one way. And there was a president who came, a candidate who came up who was so radical that Dad voted the other way. And I remember thinking, whoa. And he sat down and explained it to us. This is the way, reason I'm voting this way. Our dad was willing, when the heat got hot in the kitchen, to break stride with the tribe. To say, no, I'm not going to do what the tribe tells me I'm supposed to do. That goes kind of deep in me. I was telling Alex the other night that when my dad moved to Wilmore, he and another pastor saw that the schools were segregated. And he said, no way, no, this isn't going to work. So he and this other pastor went to the school board of Jessamine County and said, we are going to integrate these schools. This is before you came along. Our family was threatened. Physically threatened because of the stand Dad took, but he took it, he kept it. And my first year of grade school, we were integrated. So he was always one to break stride with the tribe and not be culturally codependent. So, man, I'm so grateful for that. But find somebody who you normally wouldn't talk with, somebody of a very different persuasion, and talk to them. Try it. Just try it.
Contribution. We are going to take up an offering, and you don't have to make a contribution, but you're welcome to, and all the money stays in Pathway.
Speaking of our dad, growing up, every night after dinner, when we were done eating, when everyone was done eating, we would walk downstairs to the piano, sit around the piano, and sing through an entire hymn. And we started at page one in the hymnal, and we went to the last page, and then we started over. And if we didn't know the hymn, we worked through it. And if there were people sitting in the living room waiting to take me to a football game, they sat and waited while we learned our hymn. And it used to make me so angry. I used to be so angry and so frustrated. Very rarely did I ever want to participate. But now, that is such a, I'm never going to be able to sing this song. But it's such a precious, it's why I can sing harmony. It's why I can play the piano. It's why, and this song, when I got married, I went through some really rough times when the kids were little. And I sang this song to my boys from my memory over and over and over again, and it brought me comfort, and I would sing hymns. I didn't really remember scripture too well, but I remembered hymns, and I've spent a lot of, and so Wendell asked, what do you want to sing this week? And this hymn has been stuck in my head all week, and my mom had no knowledge of this whatsoever, and about the day after we had decided to sing this hymn this week, she posted the words to this hymn on her Facebook page, so... There's no way I'm getting through this, but anyway. All the way my Savior leads me, what have I?